Good afternoon. It is one bell of the afternoon watch, and this is your Captain Joe up in the captain's chair. And I want to make sure that Captain Brigham is on with me. So, Lawson, would you check in with me right now, please?
Yes, sir. Good afternoon, Captain Joe. Happy to be with you.
So, now we're going to have my regular opening remarks. And then I'm going to introduce my friend and colleague, Captain and Doctor and Professor Lawson Brigham, and we're going to talk about a question and an issue which has been part of the discussion that so many of Captain Joe's people who listen to me every week have been interested in and want to talk about, and that is the Russian Maritime Arctic in particular, and we're also going to talk a little bit about Antarctica as well. So greetings to Captain Joe's people all over the world, and in particular Fairbanks, Alaska, where my Fairbanks family has had a little bit of a setback in the form of an automobile accident, which totaled the machine, but fortunately no one was hurt. And to Singapore on one side of the world and to the Kingdom of Sweden, of which Stockholm is the capital, on the other. On the binnacle list, the one which is of concern to me are all of Captain Joe's people who are right now either having tests to determine the severity of any conditions that they may have, or awaiting surgery, or have had recently surgery and are recovering therefrom. And it is always my concern, my wish, my desire, and my command from the captain's chair that you follow out all of the instructions of your medical practitioner so that you leave the binnacle list in the way which it is intended, and that is with a full and complete recovery so that you can continue to carry on with your life. So we move from that to a special treat for me, because my friend today is a colleague. He is a brother icebreaker captain. He is also the holder of a place name in Antarctica, as am I, of Brigham, Mount Brigham, I believe it is, and Lawson will tell me about that. So, Lawson, good afternoon to you, and let me make sure that your voice is loud and clear on the Voice of Vashon 101.9 on the FM band and stream live all over the world on voiceofvashon.org. Lawson, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, sir. Happy to be with everyone, a global audience.
It is indeed a global audience, and I always have a book, or I don't always have a book, but I have one this week, and it's one of yours. And it came to me in a parcel just the other day called The Russian Maritime Arctic, Region of Great Change in the 21st Century. It is sponsored by the Center on Irregular Warfare and Armed Groups of the Naval War College. And I have to tell our audience, Lawson, that you are also a graduate of the Naval War College, a distinguished graduate of the Naval War College, and you also hold both an MPhil and a doctoral degree from Cambridge University, and I mentioned here that you and I were classmates during our MPhil, our master's program, and so that just extended a wonderful relationship that started with you and I working together when I was the ICE boss for Commandant Jim Gracie. So I'd like to start off our discussion and our dialogue, Lawson, by asking you to characterize in some brief terms, and you and I recognize that both of us, when we get going talking, and especially when we are talking together, that we can go on at great length. So characterize the present state of the Russian presence in the maritime Arctic, with a comment in particular on the state of the route across the top of Siberia. Over to you.
Yeah, a new Arctic after Ukraine. For several decades, at the top of the world, we've had pretty good cooperation among the eight Arctic states, including our Russian friends. in the Arctic Council in particular, on subjects related to sustainable development and environmental protection. So for several decades, we've had very close cooperation, even with our Russian colleagues, on practical issues related to the maritime world. But after the February and the invasion of Ukraine, things have changed, of course. The Arctic Council, or the seven other Arctic states, I should say, have paused the Arctic Council, even though the Russians are actually in the chair. So it is a complicated space at the top of the world today, broadening it out just from the Russian maritime Arctic, in a sense of great complexity and great uncertainty. The only certain thing, amazingly enough, I would argue, is in fact climate change at the top of the world, where we will have in the decades ahead, certainly, more melting of sea ice, melting of glacial ice, warming temperatures, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, that gives greater marine access in the Arctic Ocean for part of the year, which allows the Russians and the Northern Sea Route to more traffic, more opportunities to move goods and services, principally natural resources, out of the Russian Arctic to global markets. The question that you kind of raised and hinted at was maybe new global trade routes. Well, the arguments for new global trade routes, ocean to ocean, are mute, at least in the near term, because of sanctions, because of economic, because of technology transfer constraints, et cetera, et cetera. So it is a new Arctic today, and it is a new challenge for our Russian colleagues to continue to develop their Arctic, their marine waterway, which is really a national Arctic waterway, to better say it. If you want to sail from, just one more point, if you want to sail from the Bering Strait to Europe, or vice versa, you're really on the Northeast Passage, is the formal name. The legal name, Northern Sea Route, it extends from the Eastern Barents Sea all the way to Bering Strait, so it doesn't cover the whole of the territory. Of course, we have to remind everyone that most of the Arctic, 67% of the Arctic, is ocean, and half of that coastline is owned and operated essentially by our Russian colleagues.
If there was ever any question about the way that the ice cover in the Arctic has diminished, there's a map in the book this week, your book, The Russian Maritime Arctic, etc., which shows the comparison of ice cover from September of 1980 to September of 2020. And that is a dramatic picture. And the most of the ice that has been lost in those 80 to 20, 40 years, are indeed across the top of Russia, if I'm looking at this correctly. And if I'm not, then you are entitled, as you have always been, to respectfully but firmly correct me. But as I'm reading this thing, Lawson, it looks to me as if most of that ice loss is indeed across the top of Russia, and yet the Russians continue to build incredibly powerful nuclear icebreakers. Would you comment a little bit on the shipbuilding program of the Russians? Because
I'll comment on the maps that you're looking at. Of course, they are in September, so the maps that Captain Joe and I are looking at are September at the minimum extent of sea ice, both in for the past 40 years, the gap. And Captain Joe is quite right. The data shows the retreat of sea ice mostly happening along the Russian maritime Arctic from Bering Strait region out into the central Arctic Ocean and all the way to Europe. Still a lot of ice in the Canadian Arctic and making it a much more complicated place for marine traffic. But to the icebreaker question, sure, the Russians now have two new nuclear icebreakers, the most powerful today afloat with about 82,000 shaft horsepower, twin nuclear reactors. The Arctic and Seabear are new ships, just operational the last 2 years. They're building three more, but Rosatom, the National Nuclear Agency, they want two more. So they could possibly in the next have seven brand new, very capable, most powerful icebreakers in the world, nuclear powered. But there's a whole cast of other icebreakers being built and actually underway in the Russian Arctic. Some, it's hard to estimate, 35 to 40 ships that are as capable as most of the other icebreakers in the world, and that they're spread out, mostly, of course, diesel electric, a few that are direct drive ships, but a whole armada of icebreakers supporting onshore development, coastal operations, and icebreaking along the Northern Sea Route. So the icebreakers are still an important component of infrastructure for the Russians, even though most of the cargo ships, the largest ones, LNG carriers and tankers, are being built where they are, in fact, icebreaking carriers. They're icebreakers in their own right. And the reason for that is that no one wants to use icebreaker escort. Expensive, slows the traffic. So the new modern Arctic ships are much like the MV Arctic, which was a Canadian ship from the late 1970s that both Captain Joe and I know about.
Yes, I remember
her. The newest ships, mostly designed by the Finns, Aker Arctic in Finland, are very capable icebreakers in their own right. Only in the depth of winter would they need escort. And so they can operate, I think, and most of us think that work on these issues, about 8 months out of the year, they can operate without icebreaker escort. But nonetheless, for the federal budget of the Russian Federation, the icebreakers are still a primary tool for facilitating navigation.
So one of the things that you and I talk about over the years, and in which you are much more of an expert than I, because I'm not an expert in it at all, is the geopolitical aspects of the Russian Federation of Russia, in particular in the Arctic, and I'm talking now in a larger sense, Lars Lawson, than just the subject of moving cargo through the Northeast Passage with those incredibly powerful icebreakers, none of which, by the way, would go to Antarctica because of the Antarctic Treaty. Am I right on that?
Well, the Russians tell me they could take the ships to Antarctica under the treaty, and some legal scholars have suggested that that is the case, but putting a nuclear reactor in Antarctica, we did that. The United States did that at McMurdo, but it was too expensive and complicated. So you could take the ships there, but my Russian operator friends tell me the ships are not designed to cross the equator.
Yes, right.
Because of the warm waters for, several thousand nautical miles, that their system is really not designed for those long. But the Russians have a fleet of icebreaking research ships and supply ships that are very ice-capable that can go to Antarctica. So I never sensed that the Russians ever deploy a nuclear icebreaker to the Antarctic, only because it's an expensive machine, national asset, and really used for supporting economics and moving cargoes. So for supporting military security. But so I think you could take the ship if you physically could get it across the Pacific and... But for what reason, I guess, is the answer.
So I'd like you to give a short characterization of what you see as the overall geopolitical objectives of Russia, in particular in the Arctic, and then I'm going to touch briefly on the Antarctic because that's more my end of the world. But I would I'd like you to talk briefly about what you see through, in particular, your contacts with your Russian colleagues. And I'm going to say something here that that you with which you may not agree, but to me, you are the expert, the American expert on the Russian Arctic. You've written about this for years. You and I have talked about it, and for all of the time of our friendship. And I really would like to hear what you think in terms of a larger sense, rather than just the economic parts of it. What you see is, in the larger sense, the Russian overall geopolitical objectives and how you think they might get to them. And I recognize that I'm taking a great risk here at the expansiveness of your reply, so I reserve the right to jump in and say we need to move on to something else. But this is really important to me, the answer question.
Yeah, I mean, it is all about economics. I mean, though, I would say, although, of course, it's about military security at the top of the world, and the Russians with this long coastline face what they see as adversaries all around, even more surrounded, so to speak, when Finland and Sweden join NATO, which I think will happen. Now we will have seven NATO members and then the Russians. So seven NATO members aligned in their connection to NATO. In the past, of course, Finland and Sweden trained, and I think were aligned philosophically with the West. But now they're really aligned with NATO membership, and so that does create a different geopolitical space at the top of the world. But I really get back to that for the Russians. The Russian maritime Arctic, the Russian Arctic is essential for the national economy, for propping up and supporting the GNP, so supporting the Russian military, selling oil and gas, coal, nickel, palladium, platinum, you name it, whatever we have, vast resources in the Russian Arctic to the world, is integral to their economic future. But of course, that contrast, that rubs up against climate change and adaptation and new renewables and energy transition in the world. So how long can the Russians sell at least coal and oil to the world from the Russian Arctic out? So they're going to, presumably, I mean, yesterday, I think, or maybe this morning, the EU issued its stance and will prohibit the import of Russian oil. So that's just one factor. It's near term. But the longer term economic factors of sanctions and selling oil and gas on global markets is very uncertain and complex for the Russians. They will sell more to China, maybe to India, and who knows who else, maybe not to Korea, Japan. So very complicated economic picture and stress and strain for our Russian colleagues focusing on Arctic natural resources. Very complicated picture and very uncertain because of the connection of global commodities markets to the Russian Arctic in this case.
One of the great concerns that many people have is the expansion of Chinese interests all over the world. And so give me a few groups on your take on Chinese interests and where you see maybe this is headed.
Well, we talk about China being a player at the top of the world, and they are. They have been this non-Arctic state observer in the Arctic Council. They haven't done too much, haven't contributed too much to the work of the Arctic Council. But their interests are, I think, clear. Their economic interest in resources. They, great country, they claim, and probably are, at least a large and complicated country. And they claim they're near to the Arctic, and in some sense, they are near, when you think of Tibet and other parts of China being reasonably high latitude and influenced by Arctic climate. So argument could be made, at least, that they are near to the Arctic. But, of course, they aren't an Arctic state, so they don't own, well, they don't have sovereign rights at the top of the world, except for the Central Arctic Ocean, which is a seabed in an area where it is a global commons. But if you stretch out the 200-mile EEZ from all the Arctic states, not much left of a donut hole in the center, the central Arctic Ocean, where, in fact, China and other non-Arctic states can have some direct play. In the EEZ, of course, each of the Arctic states control offshore development, fisheries, et cetera, development on the seabed, whatever. So, you know, China doesn't have a heck of a lot of influence over that. But I think the bottom line is, again, it's economics. It's their reach out to the world for needed, as they perceive, sources of natural resources.
So I'm going to introduce a term to Captain Joe's people, which has not been brought up before, but you and I are very familiar with it through its development. And I suspect that you had a hand in it. And that is that the International Maritime Organization, IMO, in London, right near Blackfriars Bridge in London, is the United Nations organization that deals with all things maritime. It is from IMO that we get, for example, the rules of the road, the international rules of the road. The term that I'm bringing in is the Polar Code. And Lawson, I'd like you to describe in terms that would be knowledgeable to my Captain Joe's people, the Polar Code, the difficulty in arriving at the Polar Code and its connection to the Law of the Sea Treaty and our not having signed it. Carry on.
Yeah, good question. The IMO code for ships operating in polar regions, meaning both north and south in the Antarctic and Southern Ocean and, of course, in the Arctic. Well, it took 25 years. I was part of it almost all 25 years, from the time I was the captain of the Polar Sea in 1993 all the way to roughly 2017, 2018, when the Polar Code became mandatory and came into force. The Polar Code is, as you might guess, an extension of current conventions of the international conventions, international agreements from IMO, the UN International Maritime Organization, which really does have, I wouldn't say control, but influence over the whole of the global shipping enterprise. And so there are three components to this Polar Code that are very important. First is Safety of Life at Sea Convention, really about the safety of the ship and its construction and safety of the personnel, et cetera. And then there's another part of this code, which is MARPOL, which is the Maritime Pollution Convention, and prohibiting the discharge of oil, as one example. And perhaps the most important component to this code is the question of who's driving the vote, to put it somewhat simply. What is the experience of the mariner and their training, not only of the captain and the mates, but the entire crew, including the engineers? And in IMO, the term is STCW, which is Standards of Training, Certification, and Watchkeeping, which is right at the heart of the code. I mean, we the way I see it is, having participated as kind of a mariner in the discussions, we can have the technology to design the ships to be safe, and we can probably implement and enforce the rules and regulations for discharges and pollution. But the hardest part will be to convince the maritime states of the world to have robust training programs for certification and watchkeeping of their mariners. The Polar Code does have, if you look on the website, you take a look at this code, mandatory boundaries, both north and south. Now, south is very easy. It's 60 south. But in the north, in the Bering Sea, it's 60 north on our side, the United States and Russian side in the Bering Sea. But in the Atlantic, the boundary follows a kind of a zigzag across the North Atlantic into the Arctic Ocean to account for the advance and retreat maximum extent of sea ice in the wintertime. So it's an important agreement among the Arctic states to have a mandatory set of rules and regulations for the world, of the polar world anyway, and that includes ships all over 500 tons. There are movement ahead to include fishing vessels and smaller adventurers and other vessels, but we haven't made progress yet on including all of those, particularly fishing vessels, which is a controversial kind of international theme for IMO. But IMO is an important organization, and we now have very detailed rules and regulations for enhancing marine safety and environmental protection at the top and bottom of the world.
So connected quickly to the Law of the Sea Treaty, to which we are not yet a signatory.
Yeah, at all of these conventions in the IMO, they all begin with this is in accordance with the framework for, in this case, the framework for the Arctic Ocean and the Southern Ocean. The legal framework is, in fact, UNCLOS. As far as, yes, it is a complication for lots of reasons, of course, that the United States isn't a party to UNCLOS, especially in the Arctic Ocean, where we can claim out beyond 200 miles out, in fact, to 300 nautical miles. But it hasn't seemed to be, are not signing, the ratifying UNCLOS has not been an impediment for us to implement and begin to enforce. In fact, the United States Coast Guard in Bering Sea and into the Arctic Ocean enforce this new polar code because anything that's passed at IMO will be vetted by the U.S. Coast Guard and the United States and State Department and all the other agencies, with the United States Coast Guard in the lead at IMO. Anything that passes musters there then is implemented and enforced by the U.S. Coast Guard, recognizing that we haven't ratified UNCLOS, but UNCLOS is still considered, particularly for the Arctic Ocean and the Southern Ocean, all the oceans of the world, really, the legal framework. So we're working off that legal framework. It makes it a little complicated for the United States, but not for the practical enforcement, I would say, of the polar code by U.S. Coast Guard and all our Coast Guard friends in the Arctic.
And our Coast Guard friends in the Arctic are, in particular, our Canadian friends. And I've got 2 minutes left, Lawson, and I want to ask you if we could do another program sometime in the not-too-distant future to talk some more about this, because it is not only important, but it's also of interest to many of Captain Joe's people. So I'm going to take the last minute that I have to, first of all, thank you very much for not only our time today, but for your constant and enduring friendship over many, many years where we worked together. And it is a treasure to me to be able to call somebody like you and have this kind of conversation. So we are at the last minute of my time together, and I'm going to take that by saying that tomorrow is the second anniversary of Mary's death. And I am so grateful for the friendship, the love, the affection, and the respect and regard that continue to be shown to me by all of Captain Joe's people, family, friends of family rank, shipmates, classmates, all of the wonderful people that have continued to surround me and with whom I continue to touch fingertips all over the world. And time is working the way that it is supposed to work, and the good memories continue to wash around me, but those memories are all enhanced by your affection and love and respect, which continue to flow to me every single day. I have a lot of other things that if we'd had time I would have gotten into. I'll cover them next week when we foregather here once again. But this is your Captain Joe up in the captain's chair. We never say goodbye. We say until we meet again. And I, Lawson, like you, remain on station and watching properly. And with that, we will meet here a week from today. Take care.